Hi. Okay. Are we on up there?
Yes.
Sounds like it. Okay. Oh, you want me to turn that light down? Okay. I can do that. The exercises from Monday are on the table. There are also some random papers to be returned. We're working on 6. The website is updated. And the review sessions are scheduled.
Okay. I figured it was easier for me to do it than to try to figure out how to teach you to do it. So.
Those are not confirmed, but I don't expect they will change. If they do, I will let you know. Both rooms were available when I scheduled them, so it should be okay. So for the one a week from today, which is our last class, oh my goodness, we'll just stay here. And on Thursday, that's the best I could do, given your preferences for afternoon and my schedule. So, did anybody else want to volunteer to do a discussion section later on Thursday, if people wanted it? Yes. Thank you. We'll see. Okay. Questions? Okay. That's from the website. We were talking about the departure stage. I was pretty much done with that, but that's where most of you are. You're departing. Your parents are dealing with that. And many of you have left your parents at home, and we've already talked about what they're doing, so I'm not going to dwell on that. And most of you have had the experience of going back home and discovering that the microsystem has changed a little bit, but when you get into it, everybody goes back into parent mode. They assume their roles when you're there as the potential dyad. So we had talked about that, and I was talking about some of the related issues of people leaving home before the expected time, later than the expected time, shuttling back, coming in and out, coming back with children is one of the issues. And what parents are doing through the process of departing and having their children depart is assessing how they've done and having the opportunity to see their children do really well in work or college, seeing their children establish relationships that are really positive and healthy, or some of the alternatives. And many parents spend a good deal of time frustrated because they watch their offspring go out into the wide, wide world and screw up, or get into situations that the parents wish they'd not gotten into, or flounder in college, picking majors, changing colleges, not knowing what they want to do. One of my advisees said on yesterday morning that if one more person asked her what she was going to do at the end of the summer, she was going to scream and probably do violence. Because she doesn't know what she's doing. She's graduating. So she doesn't have a clue. And she's tired of having people ask that question. I, of course, was empathizing with her parents, who are watching their poor daughter with all of her very expensive education, not know what she wanted to do, where she was going to go, any of that. So they're sitting there at home, and I'm just empathizing with them. They're thinking, what did that college do? Why did she choose that major? What has her advisor been doing? He's supposed to have gotten her a job by now. Not my role. And that's simply an example of what parents go through as they stay back in the home microsystem and have much less influence over their children and much less ability to protect them and to guide them than they had when the kids were there. And while the parents were often concerned about the child becoming an adolescent, thinking that they had less influence, once you depart, then they really know what not having influence is about. And parents have to adapt to that. And it's often a matter of some conflict for parents internally, but also conflict between parents. I refereed a conversation that I got into accidentally last spring between two parents whose child at 25 or 26 was had just lost another job, had just broken up with another person, was having difficulty with her roommates, didn't have a clue. And the parents, in recounting this in a group that I was leading, which wasn't the focus of the group at all, but the parents will bring in what is of most concern to them, they were having a good deal of conflict and continued that conflict in the group, blaming each other openly for their daughter's inability to get her act together. And it obviously was continuing a conflict that had occupied a great deal of time and energy for them over many years. I would love to report that I resolved it for them and made them all happy, but I actually made them stop talking about it and went back to the topic that we were actually dealing with, and I don't know whether their daughter got it together or not. But again, an illustration of what the parents in their dyad are potentially dealing with as you screw up and you go off into life, and they feel responsible, or they feel that the other person is responsible, or they blame your schools or some other setting in your messy system. They shouldn't have let you get involved in soccer because it ruined your life. They should have monitored your friends more. They should have made sure, you know, all of that image assessment, as Galinsky would call it. Let's look at the image now as we figure out what we have done as parents and how we would do it differently if we had the opportunity. And then there are those of us whose kids are stars in college and have no trouble getting jobs and they're wonderful people and have wonderful grandchildren, and everybody else hates us because of that. But it does, in fact, occupy a great deal of parental energy to assess not only what the kids are doing, but what that means for you. What it means reflected on what you have done in the past and how competent you are. But part of the Ericksonian stage of integrity that will come a bit later for most of us, part of the resolution of that is looking at how well we have done our parenting and our grandparenting. Have we been able to take care of our families as they have grown up? Have we done a good job? And in that last stage in Erickson's theory of early old age, figuring out that we did the best we could, we might do it differently if we could in the future, we can't, and coming to accept that and feeling reasonably good about what you've done is the healthiest resolution most of us get to. Some of us, as parents, have to deal with the fact that our children, as they depart and as they establish their own adult lives, figure out who really screwed up their lives. As they go into therapy, as they get divorced, as they have difficulty holding on to jobs or establishing relationships, as they regret their choices of college or not going to college or whatever they've done, they have a handy target. Because in our macro system, we assume that parents have had major influence on kids. And if the kids haven't turned out well, that's the parents' fault. Parents believe that. Everybody else believes it. And you believe it when you think about what your parents did. So when things go badly, as people are trying to become adults, they look at what happened in the system, and they go into therapy, and the therapist gets them to look at what has happened. And in my advanced family systems course, we look at what happens in family therapy, and we see that if you go into therapy, you have a problem with your own family. You go back and assess what the grandparents did. You have to look at it in three generational terms. And then the microsystem that you grew up in yourself becomes an object of assessment for you, and guided assessment, figuring out what your parents could have done better, and what they could have done differently, and what you will do differently, and why you're not doing it differently. And hope that you will in time to save your children from a fate worse than whatever they're falling into. Okay. Your parents, as you depart and establish that life, deal with bringing sons-in-law and daughters-in-law into the family. And as I've said in other circumstances, one of the issues for parents is that they don't have any control over that, or very little control. I broke up my daughter's engagement once because I didn't think it was a good relationship, but you know. But usually we don't have that much control over it. But parents are watching what their kids are doing, and then they're adapting to that. Kids are getting married, they're adding extended families for their own parents. And if you have two or three or four children, your mesosystem gets really messy. There are lots of settings out there that your kids are in, people that they're related to, and people that you're expected to keep track of and establish reasonable relationships with so that you don't embarrass your children. Grandchildren add a whole layer. A new generation and a new role for parents to figure out how to do it now, how to be the grandparent, spoiling, that's what we're for, protecting our grandchildren from their parents who are obviously misguided, and having an opportunity to, for many of us, create relationships with a fair degree of reciprocity across two generations, ideally with positive affect, relationships that can be developmental dyads, and which for many of you were important. Your relationships with your grandparents are very important. I know from some of what you've written that many of you have very close relationships with grandparents who've been a very important part of your growing up. So they become part of your extended family and play whatever role they can in trying to support your development. And it's an important opportunity for parents who have spent their child-rearing years too busy to be involved sometimes. So busy that they're in conflict about whether they should be at work or with kids. Sometimes in work situations that won't allow them to be with their children at important times. Many parents, fathers and mothers, have difficulty as they're raising children thinking that they have enough time, that they're spending enough energy, that they're engaged in enough joint activities with their children and know what's going on in their mesosystem. And those of us who have our departure stage characterized by that. We think, you know, rats. We didn't spend enough time, and now they're gone. At a time when many of the parents are becoming middle-aged, and particularly fathers, discovering and nurturing an emotional part to themselves that they have not been able to exercise very well. They discover that, and then about the time they have grandchildren, they begin to be less involved in work and want to be more involved with family, and grandchildren give them a new opportunity to do that. So grandparents often have the focus on creating developmental dyads, and grandchildren can become the target for that. The grandparents have sometimes the opportunity, the energy, the resources, the time to create the kind of relationships with their grandchildren that their parents resent, the grandchildren's parents resent. Nah. They say, well, I'm glad he finally got it together to figure out how to be a decent human being with my children when he didn't do it with me. Now, that's an exaggeration. But the potential is there that your children see you relating with their children, your grandchildren, far better than they did with you. Being more attentive, spending more playtime, being less distracted, being more interested in what the grandchildren are doing than they remember you as being when they were children. And it's important for us to recognize that we get better as we get older in some ways, and as our mesosystems change and our involvements change, we can focus on grandchildren. And that can be to the benefit of everybody in the family, to have grandparents who are still active, who are interested and have the focus on creating those dyadic relationships that will be beneficial to grandchildren. They're also beneficial to the grandparents. And we deal with divorces. The number of grandparents who are raising grandchildren in this country, I think maybe I've already said this a couple of weeks ago, the number of grandparents who are raising grandchildren because of parental divorce, drug abuse, alcoholism, incapacity of one sort or another, that number continues to increase. And now you can take courses as grandparents on raising your grandchildren. I just got another curriculum from Cornell. Parenting the Second Time Around, which is specifically designed for grandparents, for how to do it when you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, and have this new responsibility that you've taken on or that has been dumped in your lap because you're the closest relative. Grandparents have the task of figuring out how to have their children go through divorces and not take sides or alienate themselves from the parent who may be in charge of the children. How to maintain the relationship with grandchildren when your child and the grandchildren's other parent aren't speaking to each other. How do you maintain your relationship with the grandchildren? That becomes a major problem, and some grandparents can't manage it. Some grandparents get caught in the middle, and some grandparents put themselves in conflict positions and get themselves cut out of grandchildren's lives. So they're not able to carry on those relationships. Okay. We've followed Galinsky right on through, extended a little bit. We've looked at what we would think of as the stages of parenting as she describes them. And I hope you can look at each of those stages and think about how the child's changing activities and roles and settings and relationships affect the parents and how the family is adapting to those all the way along. Let me backtrack just one question. If you're thinking about any of the developmental transitions that we've talked about, if you're thinking about any of the developmental transitions or stages or events that are described in any of the reading, you, of course, are learning to do a developmental analysis on those. And a week from Friday, you'll be asked to do developmental analysis of some of the events that you've been reading about. So just a reminder that as you look at any of the reading, think Bronfenbrenner. As you look at the exam questions, put on your Bronfenbrenner hat and your lens and use that vocabulary. So what should go in to any developmental analysis? Hopefully you're getting brainwashed enough now so that when you think about any event or any situation, you're going to be thinking about roles, you're going to be thinking about the relations and the characteristics. As you think about dyads and relations, power, affect, reciprocity, changes in the mesosystem, changes in the microsystem, the possibility or impossibility or changes in developmental dyads, the exosystem and the macrosystem. Those should be coming to mind very easily now. And in any of your responses on the exam, and for the rest of your life, you should run through those as you think about any situation that you're involved in. We hope. So, with that introduction, let's think about siblings. And you have the reading by Judy Dunn that I want to talk about a little bit today. From Brothers and Sisters, chapter 5 in that book. Why would the order of birth have any relationship to personality development? If you're thinking about it, why are firstborns different, if indeed they are? Why are lastborns different? Why are those of us in the middle different? As you read Dunn's chapter, you'll see several simple conclusions based on years of research that she's done and continues to do. And you'll also see some conclusions that she draws about things that may or may not be true, that we simply don't know enough about. And the chapter presents a number of reasons why we don't know some of the things we don't know. But as you look at that chapter, she has four aspects of birth order and sibling relationship in the title. Birth order, age gap, how many years between people, gender, male and female, and large families. In the particular chapter you have, she concludes that there isn't much to be said about gender, but she does draw conclusions about birth order and age gap and particularly large families. So why would it be important? If you think about the microsystem, the entire issue of the constellation of the family, the size of the family, and where you are in it, and how many people are in it, and what their age gaps are, what their ages are at particular times. That whole description refers to the microsystem. How many dyads are possible? And of the dyads that are possible, what are their characteristics? And which ones are influential? You think about what the child is experiencing in the family. Each child in the family is experiencing a different family. Well, Gronsham Brenner says we have to look at the reference point of the child. What is it the child is experiencing? And each child in the family is experiencing a different family. Some people have suggested that it's so different that it's surprising that brothers and sisters are like each other at all, because each of them experiences a very different family. And they experience it typically at different times, and the constellation changes for each person in the family, potentially, at different ages. So, in fact, to understand the impact of the family constellation, you have to look at it over time and see how it's changing for each particular person. And Dunn gives you a beginning look at how complex the constellation of the family is. Birth order sets up dyads that have different characteristics. So if you assume that the child is born into a two-parent family, there's that one dyad that we've talked about so often. And then there's this tiny little creature having dyadic relationships with two people who are really, really, really powerful and much, much older and much more competent. So the child comes into the family having two ready-made developmental dyads. Being able to spend all of its adult-child relationship time with people who are concerned about it, ideally have positive affect, and are going to take the time to engage in activities that become more complex. So it's a real wonderful developmental dyad. So the only child, the first child in that situation, should have all the advantages that are possible in that family. Then along comes, maybe, the second child. That child also has two developmental dyads, but it has to compete for them. And it also has one dyad that it has to figure out. It's not necessarily dyadic. As my daughter said, sometimes I'd like to knock his little head off. That's not necessarily a developmental dyad. The affect may not be terribly positive in that one. When that second child is born, the whole constellation changes, but the second child comes into a very different family than the first child came into. So its view of the world is going to be different. What it's going to experience, the nature of the transactions, the reciprocity in those transactions, the power differential in those transactions, is going to be very different from the experience of the firstborn. It's going to have less developmental dyad time than the firstborn had. So it may have a little more difficulty developing a valid view of its world. And it's going to have one dyad with a person who is older, more powerful, maybe with less positive affect, particularly if the older one feels resentful about having lost the only child status. And it's got to figure that one out. But it has more dyads in which it's inferior. The baby is always the least powerful. This one had those two who were pretty much in its favor. The second born and the third born still have two, but less of their time, and more people who have more power than they do, and whose affect may be questionable, and who are less able to engage in appropriately complex developmental activities, joint activities with them, because we're talking about children. who really do like to play with their younger brothers and sisters. One of the, as an aside, or as an illustration, one of the things that I liked about having two children is that I could see illustrated some of the things going on. One of the characteristics of children in families is that as you go down the line, language development is, during the process of learning it, is slower. And some people have suggested that it really shouldn't be that way because the younger you are, the more people you have speaking to you, which is true. But the research says that as you go down the line, language development is slower and kids have smaller vocabularies. So how do you explain that? One of the characteristics of language learning that's very important is that you are exposed to the concept of the referent of the word and the word simultaneously. It helps if you hear chalk while you're looking at chalk. Then you can make that connection. So contingent language use is key in learning language. So you see the parent waving the object in front of the kid's face, saying, chalk! There it is, chalk. Now, it's hard to miss that that's what you're talking about. Watching my daughter, whose language was very good, teach her little brother to talk was an exercise in frustration for somebody who knew about language development. Because at 2.5 years older, her intentions were always wonderful. But her abilities stunk. Her ability to keep track of what her little brother was paying attention to while she was giving him vocabulary words was defective, because while she was teaching him, he was 1.5 years and she was 4. And she'd do things like, see? And he'd be looking over here. And she'd say, chalk. And by the time he had, I don't have anything in my pocket, I think. By the time he would turn around and be looking, she'd be holding up the next object, which was chapstick. You know? So the poor kid's going around saying, chalk. He got it. There's the chalk, right on the board with that. The language that older kids use is non-contingent. So they frustrate the parent, but they hinder the younger child's connection between the concepts, what the words refer to, and the words themselves. It's an example of many, many things that are a hindrance to younger children, because the older children that they're interacting with are really not all that smart yet. And they're not able to create joint activities that, in fact, are developmental. They're good for the older kid. They teach the older child to have good intentions. They're an opportunity to practice caregiving, teaching, sharing. But they're not necessarily good for the younger child and its competence. And as you go down the line, you have more and more people who are incompetent doing things with you, and less time with your competent parents. So in larger families, the language development, just as one example, the cognitive development in general, is delayed. Doesn't mean it's going to be defective. It just means that it's slower, and those kids do less well as they go into kindergarten. They may catch up, they may be fine. But one of the ways that we account for that is that in larger families, the older kids are given many more responsibilities for caregiving for younger kids, and the younger kids are spending more time with older siblings than they are with parents. There are advantages to that, as Dunn points out, and there are disadvantages. It's a two-sided coin. Okay. Yes?
Is there any evidence that some of the effects of getting less time in the developmental diet of parenting thing about stuff like the experience and confidence the parents have of having raised another child?
That's an interesting question. Looking at it from the parent perspective, the parents are getting experience raising children, and they're experimenting with number one. And you throw the first one out because it was an experiment. They're applying what they've learned to the second one, so they might be more confident at it. By the time they get to the third, they have more awareness. One of the things that happens as they go down the line is that they do become more aware of and tolerant of differences in temperament. People who have only one child don't believe in temperament. People who have two children believe in temperament. People who have three or four children know that temperament is a really important determinant of the outcomes and of the parent-child relationship. So, on the one hand, you have parents becoming more knowledgeable about children as they go down the line. On the negative side, as they go down the line, they have less time to spend with each child. And if you look at parent involvement per child, literally the amount of time that each parent spends with each child, as the family gets larger, the time gets less. And it's not evenly distributed down the family. Julie, would you make a note for me to find a reference for what I'm about to say so I can add that to the reading list? What happens is that parents distribute their time among children unevenly, and one of the variables that influences that is gender. Fathers spend more time with boys. Okay. One of the variables is interests, particularly as kids get older. So even if you have only girls, dad's going to spend more time with the athletic one than with the others. So you put those in the mix, but most importantly, the firstborn continues all through life to get more parental time than anybody else. The lastborn is next. And in the middle, I'm second of four. And we raise ourselves. And the larger the family, the more we're raised by our siblings in the middle. Okay? So, is it good or bad? Clearly parents change, and that's another reason why kids have different families. Okay? And the parents are, as the family gets larger, the parents have less time to devote to parenting and more probability of distributing their parent energy differently. And if you have a child who has a particular handicap or a need, that kid is going to get more of the parenting time. That's another of the variables that determines how much time parents spend with each kid. So you have one with special problem, special circumstance, and that kid gets more. So it's probably a wash. What Dunn's article and what this kind of analysis does is make it pretty clear that gross generalizations about birth order are probably inappropriate. And she keeps concluding that, except for the very consistent finding, that firstborns are typically more dominant. They tend to be bossier. Male or female. And they are more adult-oriented. than the other positions down the line. And that's probably the one that's easiest to understand, because they have the parents. Of all the siblings, they are the most competent. They are the ones most likely to be able to engage the adults in joint activities that are new and interesting to the adults. They are the ones who have nobody in between and any number of people that they can lord it over, dominate, persuade. And Don describes it. She said that firstborns use power. They attack verbally, they threaten, they bribe, they force their younger siblings. And they do that all the time they're growing up. What are they practicing? What's the role? How are they seeing the world? They're the dominant creatures. They have more access to and control over the resources within the sibling group. So, as she described, if you don't like what your little brother is doing, you throw him out. And you can physically do that, and there is nobody who can do that to you. So your role is to be king of the hill, unless your parents throw you off the hill. Question? One of the interesting uses of that particular birth order phenomenon is to help us understand the people that we try to relate to or the problems we have in our own relationships. And I'm not going to go into it in depth. We talked about it a little bit briefly earlier on, not in great detail, but if you look at two partners and you look at their complementary sibling orders, the people you date. You look at yours, you look at the people you date. If you want an example, use your parents. They are in some sibling order. And you might understand, your father's a middle child, your mother's the oldest of sisters. The gender is important, and the position is important. Are they comfortable with each other? And the literature suggests that two firstborns are going to have a competitive relationship. They're going to try to dominate each other. They may be very happy doing that, but that's going to characterize their relationship. A firstborn and a younger born, somebody who grew up with an older born, may be very comfortable. And the characteristics of their relationship will be that the firstborn will dominate, whether it's the male or the female. And if the firstborn has a sibling, a younger sibling of the other sex, then the partner who's of the other sex is better off if he or she has had an older partner, an older sibling of the same, of the other sex. See what I'm getting at? Younger sisters of older brothers are comfortable in relationships with older brothers of younger sisters. They're in familiar territory. They've grown up with the sibling and gender relationship that they're experiencing. So they put each other in those sibling roles. And if they're experienced with those sibling roles and they're both comfortable in them, then that's the way they relate. But if you're, for example, the younger brother of brothers, you don't have any sisters, then any woman is going to be a mystery. And if you're the younger brother of brothers, you may have learned to how not to get stomped on. And then you marry an older sister of brothers, and she's going to dominate, and you can be fairly comfortable with that. You don't know anything about sisters anyway, so you marry one, and you assume she's a... I don't want to exaggerate that too far. But the literature on couple relationships suggests that it's very helpful sometimes to figure out whether people are recreating familiar family roles from their sibling orders, or whether it's a new family role, or whether they're creating something that they have no experience with. Only children, people without siblings, have a particular role in the family. How does that play out in the couple relationship? If they've never had siblings, where did they learn to share? Where did they learn to negotiate? They don't have to. So is that going to make it more difficult for them to be partners? It's a very helpful extension, and it builds on the same characteristic that growing up, you're learning particular dyadic relationships within the family, and the ones that you experience are going to be comfortable for you, and others won't be. The question is, what happens when you blend the family then? Blended families have, with children getting blended, have many, many possibilities. What happens if you're the older of two in one family, and you've been there, you're 10, and you've had one younger sibling, and you've been the king of the hill with that sibling, and you blend with a family that has two teenagers. You now become a middle child. How easy is that? And if you look at the step-sibling relationships, when you put kids together in a blended family and create those step-sibling relationships, then how much each person has changed and what new roles they've been thrust into is an important part of the dynamic of what's going on in that microsystem. So as you try to create a comfortable microsystem with those kids who've now been forced by the parents, now here you are, you've got two older siblings now. Thank you very much, Dad. That's great. Here you are with those two older siblings, and you have to get along with them, and you've been the king of the hill for 10 years. You may have a rough time, depending on the personalities. And very importantly, and this is one of the points that Dunn is getting to, very importantly, how many competing relationships the parents have to attend to. How well can they manage the microsystem that they have? And that'll get us to larger families and small families. Melena. Yes, with a difference. The question is whether only children are like firstborns. And they are. The difference is that only children are likely to remain more adult-oriented than firstborns who have younger siblings. The only child never has to deal with any competition. The only child never has to deal with some rugrat running around. The older child never has to learn to caregive, to share, to take care of, to be responsible for somebody else within the family. Whoops. Is that neat? I'm not sure that all sounds good. So if I had an only child, and I deliberately had a second child so that I wouldn't have an only child, I'm not sure that was smart, but, it was okay. We're happy. He made it. He's graduating from college. This is great. And he loves his older sister and vice versa, so it works. But only children, if I had an only child, I would want to make sure that my microsystem included occasionally things and people for the only child to learn to share with. And I would want my kid to have experience with younger children with pets, with people who required some caregiving, so that I could create those skills that aren't going to get exercised as they do for a firstborn child. How many of you are last in your family, and what was it like, and why are the four of you sitting together? Okay. No, only three of you are the last in your family. Okay. I just saw that cluster of hands go up over there. We'll do a case study of why they're all friends. What happened to you when the next in line, the last before you, went off to college and you got to be the only child? Okay, she hated it because she had escaped her parents' attention. How many older siblings?
Just one.
Just one, okay. But they'd been focused on her and you got to hide, and now suddenly they were making up for lost time and there you were. Okay, so one of the features is that you have to deal with the parental attention. And that may be positive, it may be negative. It's going to be different. And the bigger the family, the more different it is. Some kids revel in that because they now see the opportunity, they have the opportunity to have their parents' undivided attention. And if the relationship is fairly good, it can be a wonderful time for that. That's what happened in our family part of the time. When big sister went off to camp, little brother got a month of mommy and daddy time just to himself in the summer when he was about 10. The first time he'd been the only one. When she went off for a year abroad when she was in high school, he got undivided parental attention. And for the most part, he appreciated that. You know, there was no competition for how do I get a ride here. There were plenty of people to take him wherever he needed to go. So there's the parental attention issue. How else did life change for you? You became good friends with the sibling who had left, and you got to go to college and visit him. The relationship may improve, the relationship with a sibling may improve because you're not in each other's faces day to day. My brother and I shared a bedroom all of our lives, he was older, until he left. And then because I was the only male, I had my own room, except when he came home in the summer, which he rarely did. So I got my own room. It was a huge room. It was the biggest room in the house, in fact. And life was great. I didn't have to share. And he was off there in Chicago, and he was interested in showing his little brother the town. So I got to go on a train by myself to Chicago and go see the belly dancer, you know, just all kinds of good stuff like that. So we became much closer. I wouldn't say we became closer. We engaged in new joint activities which were based on his new setting. So he extended, he created a mesosystem setting for me. And that may be a very important mesosystem setting for kids who don't have much opportunity at home to extend. Your older siblings create those opportunities for you, and that can be really, really helpful. Other things have changed. So he's getting actually less supervision, and it's partly based on the age difference. So sometimes parents are just happy to reduce the numbers and then they can read. Okay. Another example? That's a very nice entree into looking at change over time. What happens when you're younger, I've suggested, is that as you add more children, parents have less time for each. So they're less involved in the activities of each of the children. But as you go out the other end and get rid of them, you have potentially more time if you have the energy. And older parents may not have that. But you have, when you get down to the last one, the possibility for all of your parental attention to be focused on getting that last one through adolescence. So the departure, the interdependent stage and the departure stage for the firstborn and the middle and the last will be different because of the amount of time that parents have to deal with that stage as each child is going through it. The first kid gets to go through it on her own, pretty much on her own. Sometimes parents will focus on that and then ignore the next two or three and then be able to spend a lot of attention on the last one again. And then you have the family dealing with the dynamic of that as the younger one feels he's getting more help than he needs, or the older ones feel that he's getting more help than they got and they can resent that, or they can commiserate either way. Okay, so again, those examples suggest how complex the changes in the microsystem are and why families can be so different. Why firstborns are having a different experience than onlys. They don't have anybody younger than them. The laterborns have people over them. And we get to the notion of the age gap, looking at the sibling relationship. The bigger the age gap, the less reciprocity there is in any child's relationship. Twins tend to have very close relationships. They're equals. They have equal power. They have a great deal of reciprocity because they're typically going through the same things at the same time. And twins have typically very positive affect in their relationships. There are exceptions to that, but they're very rare. The number of twins who, particularly same-sex twins, who go through everything pretty much together, the number of those who go through school together, go to college together, marry people with the same name, all of those things, are indications of a closeness of the relationship that is in part based on the reciprocity and the affect. They're the only siblings until you get to potential step-siblings who can be the same age and have then, again, a high degree of reciprocity and equal power. Yeah. The birth order of twins is an interesting phenomenon because often twins do have a dominant one. But the research on the order of birth suggests that that dominance is not as clearly based on birth order as it is among other siblings. Where you see a difference in dominance between twins, it's usually based on size and developmental phenomena that may be related to having been in a shared womb. Twins are often not the same size. Twins often have, particularly fraternal twins, are often developmentally one is a little ahead of the other. And that has been, it's been suggested that that's due to access for nutrients, room, maybe just temperament for fraternal twins, genetics, even same-sex twins. And that seems to be more important than which was born first. But the twins aren't necessarily exactly equal, but compared to other sibling differences, they're much more equal, unless one of them has significant problems. If one of them has significant problems, neurological difficulties or other kinds of congenital defects, then the twin relationship is often very close, but not characterized by the same equality because of the differences between them. As you get farther and farther apart, the possibility of equality and reciprocity between siblings decreases. And if a good relationship for development is one in which there is increasing equality and high degree of reciprocity, then the big age gap works against that. You may have the older taking on the caregiving role, but the younger is then in a dependent role. It partly depends on where they are in the order and just complicates the mix. Now, do you have two kids who are considerably older than a late in life one, the one you think, I don't know where that one came from, the accident. Do you have one who's considerably older and then three or four younger ones? That constellation will be different because people are experiencing different dyads as they grow up. You just throw it into the mix. But in looking at the differences, the reciprocity is a huge contributor to that and the power imbalance. If there's 8 or 10 years between kids, they'll never have equal power until they're both in their 20s or beyond. They'll never be at the same stage. And being at the same stage intellectually, concrete operational or formal operational, is a determinant of whether or not you can have a high degree of reciprocity. Let me expand on that a little bit to talk about one of the complications. When you have kids fairly closely spaced together, you throw a little Piaget in, the youngest one is sensory motor, the next one is pre-operational, the oldest one may be concrete operational, and then we'll go into formal operational thinking. And any two kids who are at the same cognitive level, even if they're a year and a half or 2 or 3 years apart, those kids can have a higher degree of reciprocity than kids who are using different logic. The kid who is not yet verbal is at a huge disadvantage. You really can't share a lot of your thoughts with the kid who's pre-operational. And what happens in families that's fun to watch over time is that kids will be at the same stage for a while and they'll get along well, the affect will be positive, the reciprocity will be fairly high, and then one of them will move into the next stage. So you got two pre-operational kids who are just great buddies. And they spend a lot of time in fantasy play and giggling and laughing and making things up. And then one of them becomes concrete operational, develops all those wonderful logical skills that let him go to school. And his mesosystem changes because he's in school, he's in different kinds of settings. But this stuff is baby crap, baby stuff. And he's too big, too old to play that kind of stuff now. And you see, as that kid moves into the next stage, increasing conflict and reduced reciprocity and more fights between those two. The same thing happens when you've got two concrete operational kids and one of them becomes formal operational. the newly formal operational kid is usually very intolerant of the stupidity of a concrete operational person. In high school, I can think abstractly, you're just a baby, and 10-year-olds don't like to be called babies by their 12-year-old formal operational big sister. So if you track, and I recommend that you do this, if you have kids, over time, keep the baby books going for each of them, but also do one that combines your observations of their relationships and tracks their cognitive skills. And watch when you get more conflict. And watch when the kids are getting along well with each other. And my experience suggests that what you'll get is, as they're in the same stage, as they move into being able to think together and share their thoughts at the same level, their reciprocity is increasing, the affect will get more positive as well, and they'll be more equal in their power. The age difference never changes between them, but cognitively, the difference between pre-op and concrete operational skills is huge, as is the difference between concrete and formal. So you'll see the affect rising and falling along with the reciprocity. And when they're in different stages, you'll have the conflict. When they're in the same stage, they'll get along well. I use that fairly often with families where parents are concerned about deteriorating relationships between kids. They'll come. They've got a complaint. Their kids are squabbling all the time, and they didn't used to do that. And if you combine the cognitive analysis of what stages one of them has typically moved up a stage, and they don't understand each other. They don't talk. They don't speak the same language anymore. They can't share their experiences reciprocally anymore because the older one is not going to accept the younger one. If you combine that with an analysis of changes in their mesosystems, you can usually help parents understand, and then you can figure out how they might help the kids along. This analysis of cognitive stages raises the question of what happens when you are two stages apart. And two stages apart is just fine. Then you have caretaking. The concrete operational kid is wonderful with a sensory motor child. That's when you learn to babysit. And you like playing dolls with the sensory motor child and learning to baby-proof the house. Formal operational kids love playing fantasy stuff with pre-operational kids. They typically love those preschoolers because they're very charming. And there's no pretense of reciprocity. There's no need, there's no desire, there's not even any push, temptation to try to have a high degree of reciprocity. And everybody knows the power is unequal. So because they're not trying to get along with each other as equals, this big brother, big sister, or babysitter, babysat, whatever the complementary role is, that's fine. It's much more a parent-child kind of role. But in the sibling relationships where there should be some kind of similarity, the close ones, it's the single stage separation that creates the problem as one becomes more intelligent or uses a different logic than the next one. And that will be temporary because the younger one will catch up. And then they'll get along okay for a while. And then they'll go through it again. One of the things that many of you have experienced is as you have become adolescent or as your younger siblings have become adolescent, you get along a lot better. And as you go up into your 20s, and are done with the school thing, many of you will find that your relationships with the sibling that you couldn't get along with at all become much more positive. Because you're going into the same stage. You're not at different stages. You're moving ahead. You're adults now. You'll be in the same stage for the next rest of your life. And it's much easier as you get older to have a reciprocal and equal power relationship as you become adults. Okay, the large family. Birth order is more important in determining the nature of the sibling relationships in large families than in small families, Dunn says. A small family has sibling relationships over time that are much more dependent on personality and temperament and interests than is the case in large families. In large families, the oldest and the youngest and the middles are more distinctly different from each other. And in large families, the oldest typically are clearly more dominant and bossier. Small families don't pay nearly as much attention to birth order over time. And if you think about the complexity of the microsystem, it's fairly easy to understand why that would be the case. In a small family, there are a few dyads. It's not all that complex. And parents can spend time with each child. So each child gets some parent-child dyadic time. And parents can be more involved in kids' activities. There's more joint activity time. They know what's going on. And they can be more involved with all of the children at the same time if there are only one or two children or three. They can be involved in activities that all of them are involved in as more or less equals. As the family gets larger, all of that becomes less likely. In larger families, the kids are not likely to be doing the same thing all at the same time. And the roles will be distinct. The oldest kids get much more responsibility for taking care of younger kids. So the younger kids spend more time with siblings than with adults in a large family. And it's that difference in adult time and the proportion of time you spend with siblings that seems to make the difference in whether the sibling order is important. The more connected you are, the more restricted you are to your siblings as dyadic relations, the more important the birth order is going to be. And if you add to that that in large families, children are likely to spend more time with their siblings than with other children. Large families don't create play dates for their kids with other people's children. So large families are likely to have the kids spend more of their total child time with siblings than small families are. Small families arrange play dates. Kids spend their time with non-family members, so sibling order becomes much less salient. Okay, Monday we're going to talk about divorce, so do the reading on divorce.